You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th, hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
It's only a kick. A jump. A block. It's only a serve. It's only a tackle. A run. It's only for the fans. After all, it's only pressure. You got this. Adidas.
Hello and welcome to the Manchester is Red podcast. My name is Stephen Railston and I'm your host today. And I'm joined by my colleague, Tyrone Marshall.
You've got my name then.
I did that.
Been a while.
Oh, it's been a long week, Tyrone. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you, Rich. I mean, Stephen.
Who's Rich for?
I don't know. The name
is gone. He's dead to us.
Yeah.
He's dead to us. I introduced my podcast with Nathan Aspinall, Darts number four, of course, in the world earlier in the week. It's a very special podcast. You don't get that treatment, Tyrone. Just a normal podcast.
I am wounded. If I wasn't being paid to be here, I would be leaving.
It's just me and you talking about United as usual. Anyways, Ty, in this first section, we'll discuss the Gareth Southgate links and the interest in what that might mean for Erik ten Hag. And we'll get into some international stuff in the second part. As ever, usually loads to talk about. It's the junior international break, but we'll make do.
We'll find a way.
We'll see if we can get it to 45 minutes. We'll see if we can. Anyways, let's start with Southgate. As I said, growing interest, should we say, from Ineos. Is it a surprise, though? I mean, He's done a good job with England, but his last experience of club management saw Middlesbrough relegated from the Premier League.
Yeah, I mean, it's very hard to judge at what kind of level he's at, I think, isn't it? And he's, you know, I think we can see the reaction from United fans online. I mean, it's hard to judge where he's at, and he's just not a sexy name, is he? He's called Gareth for a start, with apologies to any Gareth that are listening.
Is Tyrone a Stephen?
I would say Tyrone is.
Yours is probably more sexy.
Yeah, and Stephen.
I used to get compared to an old American actor called Tyrone Power. Now it's just a mechanic from Coronation Street, so things have gone downhill a bit. But yeah, back onto Gareth. It's, you know, he's not a big name, is it? Well, he is a big name, but it's hard, like I say, it's hard to judge where he's at. He's done a good job, I think, with England. But should that put him in the frame for a job like United? I don't know. I think it's just impossible to judge where he would land if he went into club football. And I think if he got offered the United job, I think he'd A, be surprised, and B, leave England after the Euros like that. I mean, there's definitely interest there. And you can see why. Ratcliffe likes him a lot. Brailsford and Southgate have worked together or spoken a lot on all these leadership kind of events and things like that. Ashworth has obviously worked with Southgate. There's a lot of links there. There is definitely interest there. I kind of feel that if Ineos had their way and could appoint any manager they want with no reaction, they might go for Southgate. But I'm not sure they will.
And do you not think that's kind of why it came out at this point over the international break? Maybe to test the waters, gauge fan reaction?
Yeah.
Because Sir Jim Ratcliffe has said all the right things and done all the right things since becoming a co-owner at the club. But this has the potential to be a disastrous decision. Could it not?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, there's obviously been a lot of negative reaction to it. I mean, some of it is social media fans going over the top and things like that. But it's clearly not going to be a name that inspires people, really. Just because, like you say, He's done a good job with England. Not amazing, but certainly good. I think he's brought a lot of those players on. Well, I would say he hasn't managed in club football since 2009. He got Middlesbrough relegated. And international football is just an entirely different kettle of fish these days. It's totally, totally different. So it's very hard to judge what he's done with England on a club level. It's hard to know where that puts him in terms of club managers. So yeah, I think the reaction is probably one that would make Ineos think maybe not. And it should be said that there is no decision made on Ten Hag yet. I mean, if you asked United fans, Ten Hag or Southgate, you know, it'd be high 90%, wouldn't it, for Ten Hag out of those?
Well, his popularity soared in the last week because not only has he had a 4-3 win over Liverpool, and what a performance that was, but the links have emerged to Gareth Southgate. So even those who were probably leaning toward Eric Ten Hag leaving at the end of the season are now thinking, I'd rather Ten Hag stay than we'll have Gareth Southgate.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. And, you know, it is still very much in the balance, I think, for Ten Hag. I mean, if he wins the FA Cup, beating City in the final, and they get top five, say, then, you know, you'd probably say he's done enough to get another season. I think there's obviously doubts still there. I think we all have doubts. I think Ineos still have doubts. And I still wouldn't entirely rule out the possibility of some kind of friction behind the scenes. You know, Ten Hag has made it abundantly clear twice now that he expects control over transfers. And I don't think that, you know, it depends how you define control, whether that's the final say, whether that's saying, I want Tyrell Malacia and Vuk Veghorst. You know, there's obviously got to be a degree of working together. But it wouldn't surprise you if that developed into some kind of friction with Ashworth or whoever else is brought in, or Brailsford. You know, I don't think that's entirely out of the question that come the summer, there's going to be some potential friction there, which might go into the decision from either party, quite possibly. I mean, it's, you know, I wouldn't expect that to happen, but equally I wouldn't rule it out. So, you know, it's still difficult to say what's going to happen with Ten Hag, because the season is eminently salvageable. You know, I'm not sure it will be salvaged, but on the face of it, the recent form has been very good. And if he does win the cup, or even if he gets top five, you know, maybe that's enough to buy him the start of next season. But the problem Ineos have got is if they're not entirely convinced, it's a lot more difficult to then make that decision in October or November than it is to make a clean break in the summer.
We'll stick with Southgate then before we get into Ten Hag a bit more, as you've just done there. You look at his record, semi-finals of the 2018 World Cup, obviously the final of the 2020 Euros, and the loss to Italy in that final. Luke Shaw scored the goal in that game. The quarterfinals of the 22 World Cup in Qatar, obviously lost against France, and Harry Kane missed a penalty, should have probably went through. I personally think it's a controversial point, actually. I know England fans are kind of split on Gareth Southgate. I've always defended him. I think he's done a really good job. And I think he's being unique because of his personality and what he achieved in his playing career. It's a bit of a cliche, but he gets what it means to be in that England kind of, doesn't he? And he's made playing for England, again, an enjoyable experience. Players like to play for the national team now. There was all those tales, wasn't there, about the golden generation and segregated tables, and it's completely different when you look at kind of footage coming out of St. George's Park now. But then on the flip side, tactically, there's been a lot of tactical concerns, and as you said, international football is different. I think those tactics actually work on the international stage.
Yeah.
It's a different game, as you said. It's more pragmatic, slower, a bit more defensive, but that's not going to go down well with United fans if that kind of football is seen at Old Trafford, is it?
No, it isn't. Like we say, it is almost a totally different game in terms of the amount of time you get with players. I mean, I'm with you. I think he's done a tremendous job, really, just in transforming the culture as much as anything, but also the success on the pitch. I mean, weirdly, probably the biggest negative is that Italy game, even though it was the final, because it
didn't react, did it?
It didn't react, and it was too slow. The France game, you know, I mean, I've said this on this podcast so many times, but because football is such a low-scoring sport, it is so susceptible to luck. I mean, for me, England were the best team at the 2022 World Cup throughout the whole tournament. And by a distance, I would say, across all of their games, you know, they were good in, I think, all of their games. They were undoubtedly the better team against France. You know, they lost because of a deflection, basically. Maguire's, you know, the header that went in off Maguire, and a missed penalty.
If you play that game back 10 times...
Yeah, England will win it seven times, I would say,
maybe eight.
Yeah. And, you know, it's one of those things in football. You can have a team who has 25 shots, another one has three. The team that has three very occasionally wins the game. It's just the way it goes. And for me, you know, it was disappointing to lose in the quarters. It feels like it's regression, but I thought it was a huge step forward from the Euros because England played the best football and were the best team in that World Cup. And I know they didn't win it, but the best team doesn't always win the World Cup. You know, the best team wins a 38-game league season, a World Cup or something like that, the best team doesn't always win it. And I thought England were the best team, and I think they'd have, you know, they'd have beaten everyone France had to play. I mean, was it Morocco and then Argentina? I think they'd have beaten both of them, and they should have won that tournament, and they were unlucky not to, I think. But it is difficult to judge. I mean, I think he's been a really good speaker, a really good ambassador for the game. He is statesmanlike, yeah. And you can see why he would get on well with Brailsford and get on well with Ratcliffe. You know, you can see why they'd be attracted to him, because you could imagine he would represent United really well, because he is a good speaker. I think he'd get United. But yeah, I just think it's, like we say, it's just really difficult to judge him. Coming out of international football into not just any club job, but one of the biggest club jobs, if not the biggest club job in the world.
I mean, he's not won a trophy. That's the elephant in the room, and you need to win trophies at Manchester United. It is difficult. I mean, I think his personality is a huge part of it. And as you said, he does speak really well. But is that enough to manage a club of the stature of the biggest club in England? It's not, is it?
No,
if we're being honest, it's not at all. So where does that leave Erik ten Hag? I mean, I've just talked about the potential replacements for him, and kind of when fans see Southgate links, even if they want ten Hag out, they'll probably want him to stay. Mm-hmm. Could this work in his favour over the next few months? If Southgate is the leading candidate, surely it's better just to maybe stick with Erik ten Hag.
Yeah, well, I think there's a strong argument. I think it's one you made midweek that there's not an obvious candidate out there to replace him. In 2022, it was always a battle between Ten Hag and Pochettino, and it felt, you know, we said regularly that either felt like they'd be good appointments. You know, I was more towards Pochettino. In the end, they probably got it right with Ten Hag, but I think either would have been decent appointments. You know, I think I don't think there was a wrong answer there. I think Pochettino would have done better at United than he has done at Chelsea. You know, that club's a basket case. But it felt like either would have been fine appointments. You look now, and there is no obvious candidate. I mean, we're talking about Southgate. I think Graham Potter's, you know, I wouldn't rule Graham Potter out. He's got the obvious attraction of being free, essentially.
That's another name that's just... Without being disrespectful to these managers, it's not very inspiring, isn't it? If you're a United fan listening to this podcast or seeing these links, you're not going to be very happy at that.
No, you're not. And maybe that's a bit unfortunate with Potter, because in hindsight, the job he did at Chelsea looks pretty good now. You know, he's doing better than Pochettino did. And I think hindsight probably views that job a little bit better. Yet with Brighton, it feels like they went up another level after De Zerbi. Although they've gone backwards a bit this season. And they never really lost under Potter the way they lose under De Zerbi, who is another name that would be in.
Well, that's
in
another frame. Negative with De Zerbi. I mean, there's interest, obviously, in Roberto De Zerbi as well. And he's going to be available, expected to be available this summer. That kind of managerial merry-go-round. But there's holes in him. You look at that list, and there's holes in every single candidate. Yeah. There's no one you can make a serious case for. I think even Thomas Tuchel, he's kind of flattered his eyelids, hasn't he? Flushed his eyelids at United. But, I mean, his recent record's not been very good.
No.
He can't win the Bundesliga with Harry Kane, then.
Well, exactly, yeah. And you know, he only just won it last season. I know he took over, I think it was sort of springtime last season, but you know, it didn't engineer an immediate change, and you could tell there was friction there straight away. And that, for me, would be the biggest mark against Tuchel. It's why I just don't see it happening, because I don't see Ineos appointing a manager who has essentially fallen out with the people above him at every club he's been at. You know, he fell out with people at Dortmund, he fell out with people at PSG, he's fallen out with people above him at Munich. I don't see Ineos going anywhere near a character like that, personally, even if he is the biggest name on the shortlist. I think they'll want someone who would work in a collaborative structure, and I don't see that being Tuchel particularly. So I would rule him out. But like I say, there's question marks over everyone. I mean, De Zerbi stacks up well from what you hear on the data and stuff like that, and his teams can clearly play brilliant football at times, and he has done a good job everywhere he's been, but always at mid-ranking clubs. And as you said so often, when Brighton lose, you know, they don't go down fighting, they go down in disgrace, don't they? They get absolutely thrashed when they lose. And that's got to be a concern. You know, and I wrote a piece earlier at the start of the Europa League saying that their regression in the league this year, you can kind of understand, because they focused on Europe, because it might be a once-in-a-lifetime thing. They did brilliantly in that group. You know, they won in Ajax, some amazing memories. And you think if they do well in the Europa League, if they finish 10th, it don't really matter, because what an experience that is. But then they go and lose 4-0 in Rome, and you know, you're out with that tie before the second leg. And you know, you're right, there are question marks against every single candidate. I think there is not a name out there. I mean, the obvious one is Xabi Alonso, but it's telling that, you know, you're just not in the discussion, are they? You know,
I think you'll actually go to Bayern Munich. Obviously, Liverpool will have a heavy, heavy interest in their former player. And as a Liverpool legend, hero, going to manage Manchester United.
Well, it's not going to happen, I guess.
My argument with Xavi Alonso would be, surely it's easier to win the Bundesliga again than hop into a very competitive Premier League with Liverpool. Liverpool have got a fantastic side, of course. They struggled last weekend, though. pros and cons of keeping Ten Hag, I know I've kind of touched upon them, because having said all that, we've just kind of picked holes in the alternatives, but we keep on saying it's not the right reason to keep them just because there's a lack of alternatives. You shouldn't just survive for that reason, should you? There's obviously been huge tactical concerns for a long time. We've discussed them on this podcast. I guess end of March, they could still win the FA Cup and still qualify for the Champions League.
They could, yeah. And if they do that, I don't think Ineos can get rid of him, because one of the biggest things in his corner as well is that the match-going fans remain...
It's 50-50, I'd say now.
Yeah, I would say that they remain mostly behind him. There's certainly been no open dissent against him, like, you know, there was against Ranić, like there was against Solskjaer pretty regularly towards the end of Solskjaer's reign. There's been nothing like that, even though that, you know, I mean, I can't remember exactly what the stats were, but United have conceded four or more a lot more under Ten Hag than they did under Solskjaer.
All the previous records are under these managers, Van Gaal, whatever, Moyes, Solskjaer, these bad records have all been broken under Ten Hag, and you kind of see it this season, and it kind of, they've reached new lows, which is, if it happened under previous managers, you think fans would be screaming for their heads. But I think with Ten Hag, fans just desperately want him to be the man, and sick of this merry-go-round, sick of kind of player power influence it, and they really wanted Ten Hag to be the guy, didn't they?
Well, I think that is a big part of why he has got the respect of fans, and match-going fans especially, because he took on that player power with Ronaldo, with Rashford last year at Wolves, with Garnacho on tour last year being late, now with Sancho. You know, he has made the manager's office the most important since at the club again, and I think there was a feeling under Solskjaer and under Ranić that, you know, the fans had it in for the players, essentially, at that point. There was, you know, even at the start of Ten Hag's second game in charge, they lost at Brentford, the fans were singing, "You're not fit to wear the shirt," to the players, and the same under Ranić at Brighton a few months beforehand. And I think there was a feeling that players were throwing managers under the bus, and Ten Hag came in and took that on immediately. You know, what he did Ronaldo after Tottenham, Ronaldo after the interview, like we said, Rashford being late. He continued it this year with Sancho, continued this year with Rashford after Belfast. You know, he has been a disciplinarian, and I think the fans like that. And obviously, he won the Carabao Cup. He did pretty well last season. Well, very well last season.
Yeah, excellent season.
On to play it, yeah. But I also think, like you say, it is 50-50. I think the fans desperately want him to succeed, but there are obvious tactical concerns there. You know, numerous concerns. We mentioned last weekend, and I said this on Wednesday, that, you know, that is going to go down as an iconic Old Trafford day. But you look back now, and it's easy to forget, but for 40 minutes of that second half, United were dead. There was nothing.
We were sleepwalking to defeat,
yeah. And it was, you know, if but for that Antony goal, and this is, you know, ridiculous ifs and buts, because he did score. But until that point, with 5 minutes to go, your mindset is, this has been disastrous, because they've not thrown a punch in the whole second half. And suddenly they throw one and they score. Then they finish normal time brilliantly. They played really well in extra time with a makeshift team. And it's like, you know, that was an amazing 35 minutes. And fair play for Ten Hag for cobbling together that team as a, you know, Antony at left back and Fernandes at centre back. But for 40 minutes of the second half, there was no game plan. You know, they were dead on their feet. They looked knackered. How quickly things can change like that for him.
But we keep talking about this turning point, but it's been overused, this phrase all season. We've been on this podcast saying it has to be the turning point, and the turning point, unfortunately, has never really come. If you could see what he's trying to do in a tactical sense, and there was a clear plan, you could kind of get behind it a bit more, couldn't you? And I think that's been the glaring problem. If there's not a distinct style of play on the pitch, there should be. He spent over 400 million on players. He's been in charge for over 18 months.
Yeah.
And that's just not good enough, really. I mean, obviously, there has been an injury crisis, but you saw Tottenham come to Old Trafford. I know it was only a draw in January. I think they were without their five best players. Played United off the park without their best players. Yeah. And Ange Postecoglou's style of play stumbled over that there. You could see what he was trying to do, though, and his style. And his fingerprints is all over that team.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and we said that a while ago. We can't really see what Ten Hag wants to do. I mean, it's been forgotten now, but at half-time at Liverpool game, there was that image going viral of, again, the space in United's midfield. It was essentially two lines, 50, 60 yards apart.
How many games have we seen that in the season?
All the time. So frustrating. All the time. And, you know, you can see Ten Hag's point when he's saying, I'm having to play defenders who aren't that quick and we're having to defend in a low block. But they're still pressing high at the other end of the pitch, and it is creating that space and that vacuum. And, you know, you've got to be adaptable. And I think it's a difficult one because we've done all these stats and it's like 11 games, I think 223 shots against them in 11 games now. But they've also won 8 of the last 10. And you kind of put those stats to Ten Hag and he's kind of like, well, it doesn't matter, the low quality chances. And it's like, well, yeah, maybe. There's a degree to which, certainly the Everton game, they had 23 shots. You know, they were generally low quality chances. But the odds are eventually one of them's going to go.
A
better team takes some of those chances. And yeah, I think the last couple of months are so hard to judge because those concerns are still there, yet they have won 8 of the last 10. I mean, the biggest change has been the goals. You know, I did a piece earlier this week that I think when they lost at West Ham on the 23rd of December, they'd not scored. That was 4 successive games without a goal. I think they went 450 minutes in December without scoring. But since that West Ham game, they've scored in every game they've played. Scored something like 32 goals in the last 14 games, I think it is. And that, even when you're facing 20 shots a game, that's going to get you more wins. So
it's feast of famine, isn't it, with the goals?
It is. Well, that's it. Yeah, the change has been incredible in terms of the number of goals they score. And if they can continue that, I think it's something like 2.3 goals a game since that West Ham game. And if they keep that up, you are generally going to win more matches than not. But they do have to keep that up because you always fear they're going to concede. You don't really go into many games expecting them to keep clean sheets.
We're talking about this managerial situation, but the reality is we should actually have some clarity soon. I mean, Euro 2024 starts mid-June. Mm. United start their pre-season early July. So really, there's going to be a decision made, if it hasn't already been made, in the next 2 months or so, the next 6 weeks. So that's pretty imminent, really. So we should...
You'd think so. I mean, yeah. This is probably another issue with Southgate, in that I don't get the impression he would want to destabilise what might be his last tournament by saying, I'm off to United.
But if he is, you'd have to remove Ten Hag before that, surely.
Yeah, you would.
You couldn't just keep a stay of execution.
Yeah, it could become a major distraction. There's no point letting Ten Hag plan pre-season in granular detail if he's not going to be in charge. So I think by the end of the season, you need a decision on Ten Hag's future at the very least. And, you know, he's going to have a year left on his contract at the end of this season. So, I guess you don't have to start contract talks until early next season when you can see how significant the changes are. But yeah, I think, you know, certainly with Ten Hag, by the last day of the season, you want to know, is he staying? Is he planning next season or is he not?
We'll leave it there for part one then. We'll be back in a moment for part two. Welcome back to part two of the Manchester Israel podcast. I am joined with, what's your name again? Sorry.
Samuel.
Samuel's on holiday, so it can't be Rich. Yeah, Rich is dead. Kobbie Mainoo, England caller for them, Tyrone. Obviously, he was supposed to spend the international break with the under-21s, but he's been promoted to the senior team. I watched a clip of him when he was talking to England's media team. He just had an absolute wide smile across his face, beaming. What a fantastic few moments, and it's richly deserved.
Yeah, he's done a lot of media, doesn't he?
He has done a lot of it.
If you're watching,
some fantastic quotes.
He can talk. He has got a voice. be nice to talk to him every now and again. And he's, like I say, he's spoken really well. It was telling that he was called in to the squad on Tuesday, wasn't it? It wasn't, we often get these emails from the FA England squad update and it's like, so-and-so's out and so-and-so's been called up. No one dropped out. It was just like, we've got to add Kobbie Mainoo in because we watched him against Liverpool and flipping heck. What a talent. It's looked a matter of time. I mean, he just looks so, so good, doesn't he? He is undoubtedly the biggest positive of this season. There's probably an argument he might end up winning player of the season at this rate. just been.
Which is remarkable because he didn't play for the first half of the season.
Incredible.
I mean, he came back late October, obviously, had the ankle injury. That is the only reason it delayed him coming back into the team. Played a few games in the 21s, like you say, Goodison Park. And that for his full debut, Tyrone, at Goodison, that 3-0 win over Everton, that was a special performance.
It was. And, you know, we've been talking about Ten Hag and the future in the first part. Whatever happens, he deserves immense credit for not spotting Mainoo, because a player like that is always going to be spotted, but for playing him and having the faith in him. And I think he might have started the season in the team. That it was telling that Real Madrid friendly, when he got injured, he started in that game when it was the strongest team. And I think it started with, is it Mount or Fernandez playing on the right? And Mainoo was in midfield. You know, it was telling then that Ten Hag had obviously seen enough during pre-season. And it wasn't a case. A lot of time you'd see a player like that in pre-season, a manager would have think, he looks good, I'll start him on the bench. Ten Hag was clearly thinking, he's ready for my team. And it was telling that Everton game, I mean, he'd not been back in training for longer. He hadn't come off the bench. And suddenly it was like, bang, straight in there, in you go. And he's been fantastic since. I mean, I remember writing a piece after the Luton game, when United won 2-1 at Luton. And again, it was another chaotic end-to-end game. And I felt the only time United ever had control of that game was when the 18-year-old was on the ball. You know, the rest of the time, it was chaos. You know, Casemiro was chasing shadows at times. Fernandes was all over the place in the kind of way that Fernandes is in terms of chasing everything. And the ball had come to Mainoo. It'd have Ross Barkley one side, another Luton player right behind him. And he'd just like dribble out, find a way out.
He's
under pressure.
He's press resistant, isn't he?
I mean, that's his biggest strength for me, his ability to get out from those difficult situations. Like you say, be press resistant. And he's, you know, he's dribbling. We saw it against Liverpool a couple of times when he can just spot the smallest of gaps, and that ability to create space is a major, major asset in his game. And I mean, it's only a matter of time until I wouldn't be surprised if he was starting come the European Championships, because that England midfield is Rice, Bellingham and one other, isn't it? And I think previously it's been Calvin Phillips at times, it's been Jordan Henderson at times. Phillips ain't in the squad. You know, both of them, I think, have got serious question marks over their place there. So it's one other. I think Trent Alexander-Arnold's got a chance of that role with England. Like, you know, like we were saying in the first half, it's slower, you get more time on the ball, and I think that would suit someone like Alexander-Arnold, but he's obviously injured as well. You know, you have to try to think of who else could even be in contention for that
role. There's no huge competition, that's the thing, and you'd think Mainoo as the number 8 would be perfect to play alongside Bellingham, right?
Yeah,
it's just probably going to come too soon, I think. I think it will.
I think it might, this international break, but I really wouldn't rule it out in the Euros. And, you know, he's the missing link in that midfield, metaphorically and literally, isn't he, between Rice and Bellingham. Like, I think that trio would be unbelievable. And I mean, United could have had all three of them. You think there's an 18-year-old, a 20-year-old and a 25-year-old there. I mean, they could play together for the next 10 years for England.
3 World Cups, 2 Euros.
Yeah, I mean, quite possibly. And they all look, if not, I mean, I think Rice and Bellingham are world class already, and Mainoo looks on his way there. I mean, that is a serious, serious midfield. And, you know, I'm sure there'll be a few United scouts and coaches looking at that thinking, you know, what if? I mean, obviously the Bellingham one, you know, it's nice the one that gets away. I mean, they did push pretty hard for him beyond kidnapping when he's at Carrington. There's not a lot more you can do. Rice, you know, I think if they had their time again, they might push a bit harder for Rice before he goes to Arsenal, or 2 years before he goes to Arsenal. They spent 125 million on Casemiro and Mount over 2 summers. The year before, they might have got Rice for 80, 90 million and just sign him instead of those two. And I think your midfield looks better already, because, you know, I think Rice is a phenomenal player.
He's been valued at 100 million, hasn't he?
Oh, yeah.
For Arsenal, that's the thing.
He's been massive for Arsenal, hasn't he? And not just in terms of his quality on the pitch, but his leadership. And, you know, he's a proper leader, isn't he?
He's a
serious midfield.
Yeah. I remember I did open training. United played Galatasaray after that Everton game at Goodison Park. And we were all chatting on the sideline, watching the players. And the talk that morning was about Mainoo getting into the England squad, and bear in mind he just had his full debut.
Yeah.
And we were all kind of thinking, are we having this conversation? It's not a bit bonkers, but such was the quality of his performance. I've also told this story a few times on this podcast. I spoke to someone 18 months ago who looked me in the eye and said, Mainoo will play for England. And his confidence really struck us, and I mean, it wasn't misplaced, was it? And
no.
I think those who knew him and those at the club kind of knew what talent they had. And they've been proved right over the last 6 months. It's been a remarkable rise. Obviously, England have Brazil and Belgium tie in the next few days. could he get a cameo? Because they are just friendlies and it is really possible.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think now you've called him in, I think you've got to play him at some point. You know, I'm sure there's value to seeing him in training and seeing him close up. But if he wasn't going to play him, I think you'd have been as wise to leave him with the under-21s. I mean, let's bear in mind, he's not even played for the under-21s. So that itself would have been a new experience for him. So I think the fact he's been called up to the seniors, you know, you've got to give him a run. You've got to give him a try. And whether that's a half, you know, maybe more likely a half against Belgium than a half against Brazil.
Do you think you get a half?
Yes, but I don't know.
I mean, if it's just a talking 5 minutes at the end of a game.
I'm starting to think, what other midfielders are even in the squad, to be honest? Conor Gallagher, I'm guessing.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of the players, I mean, maybe James Maddison's in there, but he's not, you know, you're not going to play Rice, Maddison and Bellingham as a midfield, I don't think. So it feels like there's an obvious gap in that squad for kind of like a number, between a number six and a number eight. And I think, you know, I think Maynou's got it. Have you got the squad there?
I don't. I was trying to get it up there, but for some reason it's not going.
You sat there with so much confidence that I thought you'd got it. You should have just given me a shake of the head and I wouldn't have thrown you under the bus.
You looked at the street, unfortunately not. But I mean, it would be fantastic to see him, whether or not he actually plays his remains. I have got it here, actually. Midfielders: Jude Bellingham, Conor Gallagher, Jordan Henderson, James Maddison, Declan Rice, and obviously Kobbie Maynou.
Yeah, I mean, I think I'd be surprised if he didn't play with that list, because, you know, I think
a half might be asking a bit much.
Maynou and Gallagher are probably the only ones that could.
I mean, the thing is, Gallagher's been playing as a number 10 for Chelsea.
Yeah, he's been playing very high up.
And I kind of suggested he would be the link this summer, but he's been playing higher up. He's not number eight, really.
No. Then that role, you know, I mean, Declan Rice can, you know, he's been playing quite high up for Arsenal with Jorginho behind him, but I think you can have Rice sitting, and then if Bellingham's going to play as a number 10, like he does for Real Madrid, which he may as well do, the quality of his performance is there. You need someone between the two, and looking at that, I mean, it's Maynou, Gallagher or Henderson, isn't it? And, you know, I'm sure Henderson will start at least one of those games, but I just think Maynou's bound to get at least, whether a half is too much, he's bound to get at least some action for sure.
He feels like a player United have to build their midfield around, doesn't he, for the next 10 years. I mean, you look at that midfield at the moment and he started a lot of games alongside Fernandes and Casemiro in 2024. But I mean, Casemiro's legs, they're going on the tie, and he seems incapable of making a 10-yard pass now.
Yeah.
He's been very poor, actually, in the last few weeks. So is it the case of signing a new number six to complement Maynou in the summer? And with that midfield, potentially with a world-class defensive midfielder, Kobbie Maynou and Bruno Fernandes, is that something to be excited about? Because I think that would be title challenging, in my opinion. if you had someone like Declan Rice. Obviously, yeah. The rest of the team needs fixed.
What I was going to say,
That midfield is worth.
Yeah. The midfield.
It's a key word.
It's as good a midfield as, depending on who they got as that holder, it could be as good a midfield as any other.
But you put Declan Rice in there, as we've discussed. Yeah. That would be a fantastic midfield.
Yeah, it would. Unfortunately, they're not going to get Rice this summer. I think they need to move on from Casemiro. I think they need to try and get rid. I think the fact there's just 3 years left on his contract, that he's on $350,000 a week or so, it's just too big a risk to keep him, really. So if you can get, you know, if a Saudi club comes in for this summer, snap your hand off. I mean, I guess the big issue with that midfield you mentioned is Mason Mount. I mean, they've just signed him for 55 million. Where's he going to play? Yeah. And, you know, I mean, great squad player, but you don't really spend 55 million on a squad player when you're struggling so much with financial.
His return really went under the radar, actually, didn't it? Well, yeah, understandably, it did. Last weekend, did you discuss it on the Monday podcast?
I didn't do the Monday podcast. Right. Didn't you do it?
No.
You did the Monday
podcast? You did the Monday podcast? See what I mean?
Oh, yeah, I did
it.
It's
been
Monday
a long
podcast,
week. Yeah. I forgot Tyrone's name and he
thought that was on Wednesday.
On Monday. The international break does bad things to people. Yeah.
In my defence, I was on a stag do in York over the weekend, so Monday was a bit hazy. But I hope you listened to the podcast. It was good quality.
But no, it was a very low-key return.
Yeah, we didn't discuss Mason Mount.
Yeah, it's a very... Because that's what it says all, doesn't it, really? Yeah. Did make his return. It's been, I was going to say, highly anticipated, but it's not really been highly anticipated.
Well, no, Kobbie Maynou's done so well that that's the exact role Mount was signed for, really.
But now, does his long-term future not look like it's going to lie in the wing, perhaps, when you look at Maynou in that midfield?
Maybe, but then, I mean, Garnacho's kind of made that right-wing spot his own. Mount, you'd say, would be next in line for Maynou's place, Fernandes' place, maybe Garnacho's place, but I guess Anthony's there. But he could be next in line for three places. But that still places him on the bench if everyone's fit.
Do you not hear that, though? I mean, when you sign a new player, in my opinion, you should have their position. It should be settled. And Mount's come into the club. He was signed to play a deeper role. It's not really worked out. He's been had bad fortune with injuries, to be fair, which has disrupted what he can do and his impact. But now you're looking at it and he doesn't have a defined position, and that cannot help him winning the starting role.
No, definitely not. And if he ends up in this position where he plays, you know, I mean, say Fernandes at some point gets injured, seems unlikely.
It's never going to happen.
No. You know, say he plays three games there and then he drops back and plays two games in a deeper midfield role. Then he plays three games on the right wing. It is hard to settle into that rhythm. And like I say, I think he's a brilliant squad player. And if United, you know, if United get into the Champions League and do well in the Cups last year, there will be enough games for him to play. But, you know, I think it's pretty clear he was signed to be a key part of that midfield. And mainly we've done so well that he's essentially not been needed now. And, you know, I don't think anyone would select Mount over Maynard.
It sounds like Donny van de Beek, when we kind of came to the club, we'll think, well, if Fernandes drops out of the team, he might get a chance. Yeah. Then van de Beek was tried in deeper positions, and now look where he is. He can't get a kick for Frankfurt. I'm not saying that's going to happen to Mason Mount, but it already feels like a shame, because I think he is a brilliant footballer, as you said, and showed such quality with Chelsea and with England. But he needs to get his career back on track. Obviously, England are going to the Euros this summer. Mount was never going to be in that squad.
No, it would be a major surprise if he got in that squad. Like we said, there's a few question marks over that midfield, but I don't see him getting in the squad at the moment, because I don't see him playing enough games for United, really. And, you know, like we say, there's probably no real obvious... I mean, I guess Amrabat would be the obvious stand-in for Casemiro or McTominay, but... You know, McTominay is playing so high up the pitch. I don't really think he's...
Well, you got that answer at the weekend.
Play that role.
Casemiro is absent and McTominay played.
McTominay plays, but then McTominay plays so high up, you know, that it's almost, you know, I guess they're rotating a little bit, but I don't think anyone sees Maynard's future as a holding midfielder. He's too good, you know, in those little spaces around the box because his feet are so quick. So, yeah, there's an obvious question mark there, but there's definitely no... There's no clear route back into this team for Mason Mount. And the problem is it's not just at United now where he struggled. His last season at Chelsea was underwhelming, really. And he does need some kind of spark now to get back on track.
Luke Shaw joined up with the England camp. He's obviously injured and could be out for the rest of the season. But I just kind of mentioned in the first part how I like what Southgate's done with that camp. And obviously Shaw's not actually going to be involved or train. But I like how he was kind of invited in. He's part of the group because he's played such a key role for England over the last few years. And he should have an important role to play this summer.
Yeah. And it's telling that a lot of these players want to go in when they're injured. You know, we've seen it in previous international breaks that injured players want to go in previously. You know, previously you've had fit players pulling out of that squad not wanting to play. Now you've got injured players wanting to go just to see their mates, essentially. So, you know, that does tell you about the type of environment that Southgate can create. And I think, you know, Luke Shaw is not just United's first-choice left-back when he's fit. He's England's first-choice left-back. And I know Southgate said it was touch and go for the Euros. I mean, I can't see him not getting in that squad. It seems he can be back in May. United season... could go on to May the 25th with the cup final, and you'd like to expect now they'll get in the cup final. So even if he's only getting half an hour in the cup final, there's then going to be a few England friendlies to get in and play a few games. So I think he's definitely in that squad, and you know, there's not a lot of competition at left back if it's Shaw and Chilwell. I mean, Chilwell can't hold down a place in Chelsea.
He can't stay fit, can he, Chilwell?
No, he can't.
Ironically, never can
be
sure.
So, I mean, maybe Joe Gomez will end up playing there the way things are going. But I'd certainly have... I'd take a risk on Shaw, even if he's not fully fit, because I just think there's such a big gap between him and the next best left-back.
Harry Maguire, did you read his interview this morning? He sat down with journalists at St. George's Park. He spoke quite well. He always does, to be fair. He's quite good value when he speaks. I thought the most notable line really was his response to critics, and he discussed his season in 21-22, which was obviously a really poor season for Maguire. He took a lot of stick, didn't he? His performances weren't good enough. And then obviously last season, he lost his place, slipped down the pecking order to Sandro Martinez and Rafa Varane. I keep calling him Rafa as if I know him. Rafael Varane started centre-half, and obviously he was stripped of the captaincy as well. But he's come through that, Ty. We've kind of praised him a lot on this podcast this season because I don't think we expected it. And he showed incredible mental strength, and he discussed that in the interview. And I think it's been really impressive.
Yeah, I mean, so much respect for what he's achieved this season. You know, I've used the phrase a few times. He was a pantomime villain even at the start of the season, he was a pantomime villain. He's getting cheered by opposing fans when he's on the pitch because they're expecting him to make an error. And, you know, that must be so hard when 50, 60,000 people are doing that for you. He's getting hammered on social media, getting hammered by pundits at times. And, you know, again, we're coming back to Southgate, but, you know, I thought it was right what he said after that Scotland friendly, whenever that was, back in October or November, that, you know, the way he was treated was totally unfair, really. And it was modern social media. Southgate was pinning it on the media. I think he probably mean social media with things like that. I'm not sure the media have been critical of Maguire because he's not played very well.
There's a difference between fair criticism and kind of personal
betrayal. Yeah, and mockery, really. You know, it became mockery at times, didn't it?
Maguire would see himself, his performances hadn't
been good. Yeah, of course he would. I've been on the last two pre-season tours and he was booed on both of them by United fans, essentially. One United staff member tried to say when he was booed at the MCG that it was just that Aussie, you know, the Aussie mentality that they like to wind someone off. But I thought that was, you know, the MCG hadn't seen spin like that since Shane Warne was in his pomp.
All alone.
But you saw one at the time.
Very well done.
You know, it was, he was booed because there'd become this perception, certainly not amongst Old Trafford regulars and match-going fans, but the wider United fan base, that he was a walking disaster, essentially. And he was getting so much stick. And just, like I say, it'd become personal. It was, you know, he was being... I just thought it was really difficult to come back from that. And fair play to him this summer, saying, no, I'm not going to go to West Ham. I'll stay.
And in that Scotland game as well, did he score an own goal, if I remember?
Yeah, he did. So I thought he started that Scotland game because he came on at half-time and he played really well. His passing was really good. Scotland fans, I can't remember if they were booing or cheering his every touch. But I remember tweeting during it saying, like, you know, I don't know why they're cheering him because he's playing really well. And then 5 minutes later, he scores an own goal. When it was one of those, like, you can't do a lot about it. But it just summed up what was happening for him at the time.
A lot of time during that period, there was a lot of elements of bad luck where kind of freak things were out on the ball, with the hit off his thigh, and things just didn't seem to be going right for them.
No, exactly.
You did feel sorry for him.
And that Scotland game is a classic example because, you know, about 25 minutes into the second half, you're thinking he's made all his passes here. He looks pretty good, even though he's getting ridiculed by the Scotland fans. Then he scores an own goal and just must want the ground to swallow him up. And you're thinking, this is classic Harry Maguire for the last 2 years, that he is, you know, he is only ever one moment away from going back into infamy and being ridiculed. And the mental strength to recover from that, I think, is so, so impressive. You know, so impressed with what he's done this season, because it must be at that level when you're not trying to get yourself out of a rut, you know, a personal rut, when it's just you dealing with your inner demons. It's every time you come on, 50,000 people in the stadium are watching, waiting for you to make a mess of things, millions more on telly. To have the resolve to stand up and find your form and find your confidence again, and doing it on the most scrutinised club in the world, you know, I just think he deserves so much respect this season.
Not
a lot of people could do that. You know, that would, I don't, you know, we can do that.
No.
And, you know, it shows the mental strength that these players have at times. And you always see, like, you will see that we're guilty of doing it as well. And you say to players, you know, they should move on and just accept going to play for West Ham rather than being fourth choice at United. But you don't get to United by thinking you're going to be fourth choice. He'd have looked at it and thought, well, I'm going to get in front of Ferran. I'm going to get in front of Martinez. And he probably has got in front of Ferran this season. And, you know, if he'd have come out publicly and said in the summer, I'm going to get in front of Ferran in this team, we would all have ridiculed him and said, that is ridiculous. But he would have believed it, and he's done it. And, you know, I just think he deserves a lot of respect and a lot of credit for the way he's gone about this season on and off the pitch. And, you know, I mean, he was absolutely brilliant when he came on against Liverpool, I thought, in both boxes, really. Fair, you know, tip of the cap to him. I think he's done brilliant.
And Alessandro Martinez, he's flown out to Argentina, similar situation with Luke Shaw. He's not expected back anytime soon, but he just wants to be with the Argies, doesn't he, I guess, and have a good time.
Why not? Get a few barbecues on that herbal tea they drink.
Is there anything else that caught your eye across the international break? Because we'll get to the end of these podcasts and we'll kind of run out of stuff to talk about.
Yeah, I think we have run out of stuff.
Yeah,
I can't think of anything
a good
else.
Episode nonetheless. What's your name again? Thanks, Ty. Thanks to you.
No problem, Stephen.
And thanks to the listeners. As usual, we're actually going to be back on Wednesday for a very special podcast. Nathan Aspinall, he's world number four at darts, fantastic darts player, and he's a very big United fan. So it was a pleasure to chat to him. It's a really good interview. So check that out on your audio platforms. Have a great weekend and take care.